I was invited to speak here this evening as a First Nations representative. As is obvious, I'm not a First Nations person. I'm a Canadian of South African and German and Russian descent. But that being said, I would like to spend the first hat I'd like to wear is to deliver something of a formal statement on behalf of the Assembly of First Nations about its concerns about this legislation. The fact that you have a non-Aboriginal Canadian standing at this platform delivering remarks on behalf of the Assembly of First Nations is not an accident. Grand Chief, National Chief Matthew Kuhnkamp was in South Africa, as you know, at the World Conference Against Racism, and before he even managed to get on a plane back, he was being asked to apologize by the Minister of Indian Affairs for having said that there is serious structural racism against First Nations peoples in Canada. On his return, the AFN has suffered massive cuts to its funding, over 50 or 60%. Matthew Kuhnkamp has had to lay off two-thirds of the staff at the Assembly of First Nations. Marginalization of First Nations people is a huge political fact. And the fact that there are few First Nations people, if any, in this audience, and a non-Aboriginal person here to deliver the statement this evening, has something to do with political marginalization. In order to understand First Nations concerns with respect to the anti-terrorism legislation, it's essential to have a picture of the overall context facing First Nations peoples in Canada, which unfortunately is one of continuing systemic discrimination and disproportionate adverse impact at every stage of Canadian society, and in particular the Canadian justice system. Across Canada, there are untold numbers of stories of unlawful arrest, police violence, abuse, shootings, and false convictions, including such recent cases as the native men in Saskatchewan who were driven out of town and dumped and froze to death. The crime for which they received this death sentence was simply that they were native. First Nations people are overrepresented in the prison populations in Manitoba, where the Aboriginal population is around 10%. 75% of the prison population is native. Federally, 3% of the population in Canada or less is for our First Nations people, and 18% of the federal prison population is native. Even the Solicitor General of Canada has stated that all Canadians should be deeply disturbed about this. Government study after study has noted that the indicators of systemic discrimination suffered by First Nations peoples in the justice system, including that they're far more likely to be denied bail, be unrepresented, spend more time in pretrial detention than non-Aboriginal people and plead guilty simply because they're intimidated and alienated. Within this context, the submissions of a number of organizations on the anti-terrorism bill, and more recently a number of academics, trade unions, members of civil society, including, for example, the Canadian Bar Association, have expressed specific concerns about this legislation, including its potential impacts on First Nations peoples. And a number of speakers this evening have mentioned First Nations concerns. The Assembly of First Nations supports these expressions of concern, particularly with respect to the definition of terrorist activity and the proposed expanded power of police and the security establishment. First Nations know too well the potential scope for misapplication, misuse, and abuse that is inherent in these expanded powers. They're deeply concerned that First Nations people will inevitably suffer misuse and such abuse disproportionately, or perhaps deliberately and targetedly. In 1995, a handful of unarmed native men, women, and children asserted their people's land rights to an ancestral burial ground by occupying a corner of Ipawash Provincial Park, just down the road near Sarnia in Ontario. They had notified the park superintendent of their intentions and occupied the park only after it had closed for the season. Despite these facts, a huge and heavily armed tactical police response was deployed to quell this lawful and non-violent protest. The number of protesters in the park, by the way, at least half of them were kids under 15, and there were up 27 to 30 people in the park in the day before and night of the shooting. Over 200 heavily armed riot police, snipers, helicopters, launchers on the lake, armored personnel carriers, some hidden in a barn, some brought out openly in a St. John's ambulance, semi-truck in disguise as their command center. It now appears that the use of lethal force was ordered at the highest levels of the Ontario provincial government. The result was the police shooting of three noted protesters, one of whom, Dudley George, died. The federal and provincial governments justified this lethal use of force by immediately painting the events at Ipawash as a terrorist-like incident. Hours after the shooting, the Ontario police informed the public that the demonstrators had been armed, had fired on the police, and that the police had reluctantly been forced to return fire. Weeks later, in late 1995, the federal government got in on the act and reported to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial summary and arbitrary executions that armed natives in the park had fired on the police and the police had been forced to return fire. 6 years later, even after a conclusive judicial finding, the native demonstrators were unarmed. The governments of Ontario and Canada have not corrected this record, and they refuse to remove the slander of insurgency that had cast on First Nations descent at Ipawash and in Canada generally. Ipawash stands as just one case study amongst many which demonstrates the risk posed to First Nations of legislation which gives heightened powers to police, narrows the civil rights of those involved in legitimate dissent, and limits or suspends the civil rights as those perceived by the government to be involved in, quote, terrorist activities. The repeated characterization of First Nations peoples as insurgents in the past justifies their grave concerns about the risk of anti-terrorism legislation harming their most fundamental Aboriginal treaty and other human rights. It points to the grave need to define terrorist activity in a much more precise and careful way, so as to ensure that the net of the expanded provisions is not broadly cast. Although Canada is perhaps one of the more free and democratic societies in the world, its governments and law enforcement institutions, from a First Nations perspective, are woefully infallible. And as far as many First Nations people are concerned, they're often malintentioned at the highest levels. As you may well know, First Nations peoples across this country suffer conditions of mass poverty and unemployment, ill health, and epidemic rates of suicide. As noted by the United Nations Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights in its most recent review of Canada's human rights record, gross disparities exist between Aboriginal peoples and the majority of Canadians. The causes of these conditions, First Nations landlessness and dispossession, its contravention of their Aboriginal treaty and other constitutional rights go significantly unremedied. First Nations peoples continue to be, as stated by the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples in 1996, as being on the margins of Canadian society and either excluded or positioned at the back of the line. In 1999, the UN Human Rights Committee confirmed that the situation of Aboriginal peoples in Canada is the most pressing human rights issue facing Canadians. In this context of continuing political and social exclusion and socioeconomic marginalization, First Nations demonstration, protest, and even civil disobedience often remain the only effective means available to defend and assert Aboriginal and treaty rights. The Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples is an example of direct and peaceful is an example of the result of one direct and peaceful protest. Yet many times when First Nations people exercise these rights, such as at Burnt Church or at Ipawash, or as we speak at Sun Peaks in British Columbia, the law is often used to punish or prevent them. One technique of intimidation and quelling of First Nations dissent is the practice of systematically charging Native peoples engaged in exercising their rights with criminal or regulatory offences. Now, high school speakers tonight have spoken of how systematically that's being used against youth as well. The technique of charging entire groups of natives, and I mean this entire groups of natives, asserting their rights has not stopped, even though time and again the great majority of them accused in such demonstration contexts are ultimately acquitted of all charges. This was the story at Epawash. It was the story at Ocha. It's the story that's turning out to be the case at Burnt Church, where prosecution took on the appearance of persecution. Justice Minister McLellan has stated that the native assertions of Aboriginal and treaty rights are not intended to be captured by the broad definition of terrorist activity in the bill. First Nations are not reassured. The actions of government in the past lead them to fear that the strictest force of law is inevitably applied to First Nations. Protest and dissent, including First Nations, fear the misapplication of the terrorist legislation in the future. And the question now to ask, and I'll come to this again in a second, is whether this will actually be an accidental misapplication or is ultimately the intended effect of this law. If the legislation is not intended to cover assertions of Aboriginal treaty rights by First Nations people, then it should say so explicitly. There is no reason not to make this legislative intent absolutely clear. The AFN calls and has called for this bill to be amended so that the assertion by Aboriginal peoples of their Aboriginal treaty rights is specifically excluded from the definition of terrorist activity. The AFN court that joins the Canadian Bar Association and other organizations in calling for the deletion of the entire subparagraph E, and Professor Roach referred to that, in the definition of terrorism so that civil disobedience, unlawful but legitimate dissent by First Nations peoples and by other groups cannot be defined as terrorism. First Nations continue to face unlawful state and other encroachment on their lands, their resources, and their means of subsistence. They insist that they must have access to broad means of expression and protest as a matter of cultural survival without fear of being labeled or detained as terrorists. The AFN has made a number of other technical submissions to the House of Commons Committee, which I won't go into in detail. But want to, in closing on this point, underline that First Nations' historical and modern experience with the Canadian justice system lead them to believe that a sunset clause is also essential. A study of the Osgoode Society for Canadian Legal History has found that in the 19th century, disproportionate execution, purportedly mandated by law, was used by the Crown against First Nations peoples as a means of colonial subjugation. In the 20th century and now, First Nations people face disproportionate imprisonment and highly selective prosecution. Peter Russell of the University of Toronto has concluded, and I quote, that the application of the rule of law, an essential element in the liberal treatment of Indians, can serve as a blunt instrument for their dispossession and subjugation. First Nations can only fear the misapplication of this anti-terrorism law against their citizens. They are not alone in raising this fear. Others across the country have noted that the proposed legislation would appear to inhibit, if not prohibit, demonstrations and other forms of expression by First Nations asserting their rights. If I may for a moment longer, Mr. Chair, I'll take 3 minutes. I'd like to take off my somewhat uncomfortable hat as a First Nations spokesperson and just make a couple of general remarks. It's sometimes said in contexts like this that the innocent have nothing to fear. One of our high school speakers, and I don't remember which one it was, said, you know, we'd like to know what the impacts of this are going to be on ordinary Canadians. As the introduction said, I grew up in a context in which legislation like this was the norm, which was apartheid South Africa. And prior to the South African Terrorism Act, and I remember attending a university protest meeting just like this one in 1968 or 1969, when the Terrorism Act was enacted. It was preceded by legislation that came before it. The Terrorism Act contained an indefinite detention clause. But there were acts before it, which originally provided for 72 hours of detention, which was lengthened to 10 days, which was then lengthened to 30 days, which was then lengthened to 90 days, which was then lengthened to 180 days, which were all precursors to the Terrorism Act. One doesn't suddenly wake up and find that we live in a state in which civil rights and democratic freedoms and the ability to dissent and to hold offensive and, and, and otherwise in-your-face views are suddenly gone. It happens on a slippery slope. And I suspect the speakers that have said now this evening that something changed on September 11th. My view of what changed on September 11th is that one end of the continuum, the state that seeks to concentrate and hold and exercise ever greater amounts of power, is making hay under the shadow of the collapse of those two buildings in New York. There is no rational relationship, as some of our speakers have said, between this legislation and a response to terrorism. The McDonald Commission in the 1970s, was it, looked at the whole issue of RCMP wrongdoing. Who was RCMP wrongdoing used against that was being inquired into in the 1970s here in Canada? It was disproportionately, the Commission found, used against First Nations people and against people with groups with unpopular opinions. Those powers were supposed to have been constrained through the enactment in 1982 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. I suspect that the collapse through terrorist activity of those two buildings in New York is now being used as a cover to try and get that pendulum to swing away from those Charter of Rights and Freedoms, imperfect protections of our freedoms, but freedoms nevertheless, and back to an era when governments and security forces had powers that they could use against the forces of dissent. My fear is that this law, the fear should not be, might this law be used against us? This law, if enacted, with many of its current deficiencies in place, will be used against us. Thanks very much.